Chapter 14. The Oregon's bow cut through the darkened waters of the Ionian Sea with ease. Her revolutionary magnetohydrodynamic engines could have pushed her through 4 feet of pack ice just as effortlessly. They were just west of Corinth, having rounded the Peloponnesian Peninsula, and were driving due east to get into position. There was little maritime traffic around the ship. What showed on the radar scope were a couple of coastal fishing boats, probably trawling for squid feeding near the surface at night. For the moment, Eric Stone was pulling double duty. Seated in his navigator's station, he had control of the ship, but he had turned one of Mark Murphy's computer monitors toward him so he could take over flying the UAV still circling over the responsivist complex. When they got closer to shore and steering the ship would demand his full concentration, he would turn the drone over to Gomez Adams, who was on final approach in the damaged Robinson.
"Oregon, this is Gomez."
Holly had put the helicopter's comm channel on the overhead speakers.
"I have you in sight."
"Roger, Gomez. Commencing deceleration," Max said from the captain's chair.
5 knots, if you please, Mr. Stone."
Eric made a few keystrokes to slow the volume of water gushing through the Oregon's drive tubes until he could reverse the pumps and drop the ship down to the required speed. They had to maintain some headway in order to keep the ship from rolling with the swells and complicating Adams's landing. Max spun his seat so he could see the damage control officer standing at his station at the back of the room.
"Fire team's ready?"
"In full gear, sir," he said immediately. "And I've got my fingers on the triggers for the water cannons."
"Very good.
Holly, tell George we're ready when he is."
Max keyed the intercom to the hangar where Dr. Huxley was standing by.
"Julia, George is only a couple of minutes out."
A bullet had only grazed the pilot's calf, but Max Hanley felt as guilty as if the entire team had been wiped out. No matter how anyone tried to rationalize it, Juan and the others had put themselves in danger because of him. And now the mission, which should have been simple, had thoroughly fallen apart. So far, George's flesh wound was the only injury, but Juan had dropped off the tactical net and Holly couldn't raise him. Linda had Link, Eddie, and Kyle with her in the van, and they reported a heavily armed jeep in close pursuit. For the 100th time since the chairman was first ambushed, Max cursed their decision to use only non-lethal weapons. No one had expected an army of armed guards. Hanley still hadn't yet considered the implications of so many weapons at a cult's compound, but it didn't bode well. From everything he'd heard and read since his ex had called him, the responsivists weren't violent. In fact, they eschewed violence in all its forms. How this connected to the mass murder aboard the Golden Dawn, he didn't know. Were the responsivists at war with some other group? And if so, who were they? Another cult no one had heard of? A group willing to kill hundreds of people just because the responsivists believed in population control? To Max, none of it made sense. Nor did it make sense that his only son would get mixed up with a group like this. He so wanted to believe that none of it was his fault. A lesser person would have been able to convince himself of just that. But Max knew where his responsibilities lay, and he had never shied away from them. For now, he compartmentalized his guilt and focused on the big screen, where a window had opened with a camera view of the helipad over the Oregon's aftmost cargo hatch. Lit only by the moon, the damage to their R-44 looked extensive as George flared the chopper over the stern railing. Smoke poured from the engine cowling in dense waves that were twisted into a wreath by the whirling blades. This was another example of why no one ever questioned Adams's courage. He'd flown the crippled chopper over 20 miles of empty sea rather than do the safe thing and land it in some farmer's field. Of course, that would have raised all sorts of questions with the Greek authorities. And the chairman's Plan C called for everyone to be on the boat and in international waters as quickly as possible. George hovered the helicopter a few feet off the deck and slowly lowered it. An instant before the skids kissed, a massive gush of smoke erupted from the chopper's exhaust. The engine had seized, and the Robinson smacked into the launching pad hard enough to crack a strut. Max could see George calmly shutting down the helo's systems one by one before unstrapping himself. As the hangar elevator began to descend, George looked straight at the camera and threw a cocky, one-sided grin. One safely home, Max thought. Six more to go. With a flat rear tire, the rental van drove like a pig. Linda had to wrestle it through the corners as she maneuvered them toward the new National Road, the main artery back off the Peloponnese. Her rearview mirrors were thankfully clear, but she knew that wouldn't last. While Link prepared the ropes, Eddie scrounged the inside of the van for anything they could use to slow their eventual pursuers. Linda had used a laptop to control the UAV, so that was useless, but she had installed a rolling chair and a small desk Eddie could toss out the back doors. He'd also pooled all their weapons and ammunition. He had 3 pistols and 6 extra magazines of plastic bullets. The rounds would probably blast through a windshield, but bounce off tires like spitballs. They flashed through tiny villages that clung to the sides of the road, a clutch of stucco buildings, homes, a taverna with seating under grape trellises, an occasional staked goat. Although foreigners were building vacation houses along the coast, just a mile or two inland, it looked as if life hadn't changed in this part of the world for 100 years. Something caught Linda's eye, a flash in the mirror. There had been no other traffic this late at night, so she knew it had to be the headlights of one of the jeeps she'd spied back at the compound. "We're about to have company," she said, and pressed the accelerator a bit harder, balancing speed against the burst tires shredding. "Let them get right up to us," Eddie called from the rear of the van, his voice jumping in time with the flattened wheel. He had one hand on the door handle and the other on a pistol. The jeep had to be doing 80 miles an hour and ate the distance in seconds. Peering out the back window, Eddie watched them come and realized they weren't going to tuck in behind the van, but come alongside it. "Eddie!" Linda cried. "I see it." He threw open the door when the jeep was 10 yards back, firing as fast as he could pull the trigger. His first rounds bounced off the jeep's hood and grill, but the next few found the windshield. They punched neat holes through the glass, forcing the driver to swerve and slow. For a moment it looked like he was going to roll the 4x4, but at the last second he cranked the wheel in the opposite direction of the jeep's slide, and its left wheels crashed back to the pavement. Almost immediately, he started after the fleeing van. "Link, down! Linda, hold on!" Eddie shouted when the guard in the jeep's passenger seat raised himself over the windscreen. He cradled an assault rifle. The guns chattering and the metallic whine of bullets chewing through sheet steel came at the same time. The windows in the van's back doors exploded, showering Eddie Seng in a cascade of diamond chips. Metal crackled with heat where rounds punched through, and one bullet ricocheted inside the van before embedding itself in the back of Linda's chair. Eddie raised his second pistol over a window frame and fired blindly, while Link used his body to shield Kyle Hanley's unconscious form. "I don't know how you did it," Linda called from the driver's seat. She was hunched over the wheel and looking at the side rearview mirror. "You hit the shooter in the chest." "Did I kill him?" Eddie was slamming home fresh magazines. "Can't tell. A guy in the back is taking his gun." "Hold on." Linda hit the brakes and swerved into the jeep's lane. The two vehicles came together with a sickening crash, the van riding up onto the jeep's bumper for a moment before coming back down with a hard bounce. The limp passenger was thrown from the jeep, while the men in back crashed into the roll bar. Hitting the gas again, Linda bought them a 100-yard head start before the guards could regain the hunt. "Horrigan, how far are we?" Eric Stone answered immediately. "I have you in sight from the UAV. You've got another 6 miles. Linda cursed. "To make matters worse," Stone continued, "there are 2 more jeeps coming up behind the first. One's maybe a quarter mile back and the other a little farther."
The jeep came up on them again, but rather than get too close, it hung back, and the armed guard started firing at the van's tires. Linda worked the wheel to foul his aim, but she knew it was only a matter of time.
"Any bright ideas back there?"
"I'm afraid I'm out," Eddie admitted, but then his face brightened. He tapped his radio mic.
"Eric, crash the UAV into the jeep."
"What?"
"The drone. Use it like a cruise missile. Hit the passenger compartment. It should still have enough fuel on board to blow up on impact."
"Without it, we won't be able to pick up the chairman," Stone protested.
"Have you heard from him in the past 5 minutes?"
The question hung in the air.
"Do it!"
"Yes, sir." No sooner had Cabrillo hit the pavement in front of the jeep, its driver hit the gas. Juan had a fraction of a second to flatten himself and reach up as the bumper loomed over him. He grasped its underside with the jeep picking up speed, dragging him down the road. He reached up higher to get his backside off the rough pavement while rubber was chewed off his boots. He hung on like that for a couple of seconds to catch his breath. He'd lost the mini Uzi but still had a Glock in a holster at his hip. He doubled his grip with his left hand and used his right to grab his earbud and set it in place in time to hear the last exchange between Eddie and Eric.
"Negative on that," he said, his throat mic easily negating the engine roar inches from his face.
"Juan," Max shouted in jubilation.
"How are you?"
"Oh, I'm hanging on."
He tilted his head back so he could look up the road. Even with everything upside down, he saw two sets of car taillights and the unmistakable flicker of rifle fire from one of them.
"Give me 30 seconds and the van'll be in the clear."
"That's about all the time we have left," Linda cautioned.
"Trust me."
With that, Cabrillo tensed his shoulders and pulled himself higher so that he was lying across the bumper just out of the driver's view. Clutching the grill as tightly as he could, he cross-drew the Glock from its holster with his left hand. He pushed off with his right to vault over the hood. He drew down as he came up, double-tapping the driver in the chest. At this range, the plastic bullets would have been fatal had the driver not worn a Kevlar vest. As it was, the two slugs hit with the kinetic energy of a mule, blowing every molecule of air out of the driver's lungs. Cabrillo scrambled across the hood, clutching the wheel as the driver released it, his face already a deathly white as his mouth worked soundlessly to draw air. Cabrillo kept to the middle of the road by looking back at where they'd been rather than forward where they were heading. It didn't help that the driver kept his foot pressed to the gas pedal. Juan had no choice but to reach over the dash with his pistol and shoot the man in the leg. Blood splattered the dash, the driver and Cabrillo, but the shot had the desired effect. The driver's foot came off the gas and the jeep began to slow. When they were down to 20 miles per hour, Cabrillo leveled the pistol between the driver's pain-seared eyes. Out. The driver jumped clumsily, falling to the macadam, clutching his bleeding thigh and coming to a stop in a heap of abraded skin and broken limbs. Juan swung over the lowered windscreen, settled into the driver's seat, and started after the first jeep. In his mirror, he could see a set of headlights barreling down the road and rightly assumed it was another contingent of responsivist guards. The tenacity of their pursuit set off all sorts of alarm bells in his mind, but that was something to think about when they were well away from here. The men firing at the van had no reason to suspect Juan's jeep as he came up behind them, even as the third jeep narrowed the gap. They flashed under a sign announcing in both Greek and English that they were fast approaching the entrance ramp for the new national road and its vital bridge over the Corinth Canal, so it was the timing, not the execution, that worried him. It would have to be perfect. The ramp was coming up on their right. The third jeep was 50 yards back, and bullets continued to ping off the side of the van ahead. "Linda," Juan said, eyeing the jeep in front and the one coming up behind him, "speed up as fast as you can go. Don't worry about losing the tires. Just floor it." The van started to open a gap between it and the jeep, but the jeep's driver fed it a bit more gas and closed the gap again.
Cabrillo came up to the Jeep's bumper and hit it with what police refer to as PIT, or Precision Immobilization Technique. The impact wasn't very hard and didn't need to be. The trick was to hit in such a way that the back end of the target vehicle gets spun around. Feeling like a stock car driver gunning for the lead, Juan hit the Jeep a second time, just as the driver corrected from the first impact. This time, there was no saving it, and Juan had to crank his wheel hard to the left as the responsivist's 4x4 careened out of control, swinging in a wide arc across the road before its two left tires hooked and the Jeep began to flip over and over, shedding bits of sheet metal and the bodies of its occupants as it rolled. The Jeep came to rest on its roof, lying across the single-lane entrance to the throughway, effectively blocking it. Linda's back was covered, and she was clear to make her run for the bridge. Juan kept watching his rearview mirror. The party in the third Jeep slowed as they approached the on-ramp, but must have soon realized their quarry had escaped, because they accelerated again after Cabrillo, who continued to drive toward the heart of Corinth. No one in the op center could believe what they saw from the flying drone until Eric radioed Cabrillo.
Is that you and the second Jeep, Chairman?
Affirmative.
Nice piece of driving.
Thanks. How's everything look?
Linda and her team are in the clear. There are no other vehicles coming out of the responsivist's stronghold, and so far, your fireworks display hasn't caught the attention of the local authorities. We're about 2 minutes from entering the canal. George just came in from the hangar and will be taking over the UAV.
What about my route through town?
Last sweep looked clear. As soon as Linda reaches the bridge, you'll have primary aerial coverage.
Okay, see you soon.
Wearing his flight suit with the pant leg cut off and a large bandage taped to his thigh, George Adams settled himself at a computer, keeping the injured leg extended stiffly.
How you doing? Max asked, trying to sound more gruff than normal to hide his guilt.
One more scar to impress the ladies. Huck's only needed 8 stitches. I'm more worried about the Robinson. Talk about giving something the Swiss cheese treatment. There were 11 holes in the canopy alone.
Okay, Stoney, I'm ready.
Eric flipped UAV control to Adams so he could concentrate on getting the big freighter through the Corinth Canal. First proposed during Roman times, a canal across the narrow isthmus was beyond their capabilities. Being master engineers, the Romans built a road, which the Greeks called the Diakos, instead. Cargo was removed from ships at one end, and both freight and vessel were loaded onto wheeled sleds that were dragged by slaves to the other terminus, where the ships were refloated and reloaded. It wasn't until the end of the 19th century that the technology had evolved to excavate a proper canal and save modern cargo vessels the 160-mile journey around the Peloponnese. After a failed French effort, a Greek company took over and completed the canal in 1893. At a little less than 4 miles long and only 82 feet wide at sea level, there wasn't much to note about the canal except for one special feature. It was carved through solid rock that soared more than 250 feet above the ships transiting through it. It was as though an axe had cleaved the living rock to create the narrow passage. A favorite tourist activity was to stand on one of the bridges that span the canal and peer down at the ocean-going ships far below. Had it not been for the lights of the tiny town of Poseidonia, the view on the Oregon's main screen would have looked as though the ship was racing toward a cliff. The canal was so narrow it was difficult to spot. It was just a fractionally lighter slash on the dark stone. An occasional headlight swept along the main bridge a mile inland.
"You sure about this, Mr. Stone?" Max asked.
"With the high tide, we'll have 4 feet clearance on each side of our wing bridges. I can't promise I won't scrape some paint, but I'll get us through."
"Okay, then. I'm not going to watch this on TV if I can get the live show. I'll be up on the bridge."
"Just don't go outside," Eric cautioned, a little uncertainty in his voice.
"You know, just in case."
"You'll do fine, lad."
Max took the elevator topside and emerged on the dim pilot house. He glanced aft to check where crewmen were making preparations under the direction of Mike Trono and Jerry Pulaski, two of Link's best gun dogs. Crewmen were also stationed at the bow. The ship was steaming at nearly 20 knots as it made its approach. Though the canal is used today primarily by pleasure boats and sightseeing craft, any large vessel was towed through by tugs because of its tight confines and speed was limited to just a few knots. Max had supreme confidence in Eric Stone's ship-handling abilities, but he couldn't ignore the tension nodding his shoulders. He loved the Oregon as much as the chairman and hated to see even a scratch mar her intentionally scabrous hide. They passed along breakwater to starboard, and the collision alarm sounded through every compartment on the ship. The crew knew what was coming and had taken the proper precautions. Small bridges running along the coast road spanned each end of the canal. Unlike the high truss bridges that towered over the water, these two-lane structures were just above sea level. To accommodate ships transiting the waterway, the bridges could be mechanically lowered until they rested on the seafloor so that vessels could pass over them. Once the ship was clear, the bridges were cranked back into place and cars could cross once again. With her bow configured and reinforced to crash through sea ice, the Oregon slammed into the bridge, riding up on it in an ear-splitting squeal of steel. Rather than crush the bridge, the tremendous weight of the hull snapped the locks that held it in place, and it sank under the hull. The Oregon came back down with a tremendous splash that sloshed back and forth against the canal sides and dangerously slewed the ship. Max looked up. It was as if the canal's featureless rock walls reached the heavens. They dwarfed the ship, and up ahead, the automobile and railroad bridges looked as light and delicate as girders from his boyhood erector set. The tramp freighter continued to charge through the canal, and to Eric's credit, he kept it dead center, using the Oregon's athwartship thrusters with such delicacy that the flying bridges never once touched the side. Max chanced stepping out on one and walking all the way to the end. It was foolish and dangerous. If Eric made a mistake, a collision at this speed would tear the platform off the superstructure. But Max wanted to reach out and touch the stone. It was cool and rough. At this depth, the canal remained in shadow for most of the day, so the sun never had the chance to warm it. Satisfied, he hurried to the bridge just as the Oregon heaved slightly and the railing smacked the canal wall. Eric shifted their heading infinitesimally so as not to overcorrect and centered them once again. "Linda's van is just about at the new National Road Bridge," Gomez called over the intercom. "I can see the chairman, too. He's still got a good lead on the jeep chasing him." "On my way down," Max said, and moved for the elevator. The damaged tire finally shredded a quarter mile from the bridge, and they covered the distance riding on the rim, sparks shooting from the back of the van like a Catherine wheel. The sound was like fingernails across a chalkboard, something Linda hated more than any other noise in the world. She wasn't sure what made her happier when they reached the center of the span, that they were almost home free, or that the unholy shriek had ended. Franklin Lincoln threw open the side door as soon as they stopped. He could see the Oregon fast approaching and heaved three thick nylon climbing ropes off the bridge. The ropes were secured around the van's seats and through a frame member that was exposed in the cargo area. They uncoiled as they fell through space and came up just 10 feet shy of the sea. Linda quickly jumped out of her seat and donned her rappelling gear. Harness, helmet, and gloves, while 200 feet below them, water frothed at the Oregon's stern as reverse thrust was applied to slow her. With the power of her massive engines, she lost headway almost immediately. Link had already strapped himself into a harness used by tandem parachute jumpers, and with Eddie's help, they had clipped an unconscious Kyle Hanley to him. The three of them then secured themselves to the lines and waited for word from down below. On the Oregon, crewmen at the bow grabbed the dangling ropes and guided them aft as the vessel crept forward, making sure they didn't become entangled with the superstructure, communications antenna, or any of the hundreds of things that could snag them. As soon as the men reached the aft deck, Max ordered his people to go. Never one to be bothered by heights, Linda stepped onto the guardrail and started lowering herself from the bridge. Eddie was on one side of her, and Link, carrying Kyle, made his way down the other. They lowered themselves down the bridge's underpinning girders, and then, suddenly, they were dangling 200 feet over their ship, nothing holding them in place but the 3/4-inch lines. With a whoop, Linda shot down her rope like a runaway elevator. Eddie and Link quickly followed, almost free-falling through space before using their rappelling harnesses to slow their descent. They touched down at almost the same time and stood still so that their crewmates could unhook them from the ropes. The line's trailing ends were quickly knotted around cast-iron bollards bolted to the ship's deck. Breathless from the adrenaline rush, Linda said, "Now for the fun part." Watching the action on deck from the closed-circuit television system, Eric Stone didn't wait for orders. He eased the T-handle throttle forward slightly to edge the ship farther up the canal. The slack in the ropes vanished in an instant, and then they quivered for a second before the ship's thrust rolled the rental van over the guardrail. It plummeted like a stone, smashing into the water just behind the Oregon's fantail. The impact flattened its roof and blew out all its windows. The weight of its engine caused the van to upend, like a duck diving for food, and it bobbed in the ship's wake for a moment before filling with water and sinking out of sight. They would tow the ruined vehicle well into the Aegean before cutting the ropes and allowing the van to sink to the bottom. The van was rented by a disguised crew member using false identification, and there would be no link back to the corporation. And only one more person needed to rejoin the ship for the mission to be considered a success, even if they had to go so deep into their playbook that they had to use Plan C. Cabrillo raced toward the Corinth Canal, flashing by villages and small farms in a blur. In the moonlight, stands of conical cypress trees looked like army sentries guarding the fields. No matter how recklessly he took corners or how brutally he punished the Jeep's transmission, he couldn't shake his tail. Denied returning their kidnapped member, the men chasing him wanted blood. They drove just as hard, using both lanes of the road and often skidding into the gravel verge in their pursuit. They had managed a few pot shots at Cabrillo, but at the speeds they were traveling, there was no chance to fire accurately, and they'd stopped, presumably to conserve ammunition. Juan regretted not raising the windscreen as he squinted against 80-mile-an-hour wind. It didn't help that a breeze had picked up, and grit as nebulous as smoke drifted across the road and scoured his eyes. He flashed past the site of ancient Isthmia. Unlike other ruins dotting Greece, there was nothing to see on the low hillock, no temples or columns, just a sign and a tiny museum. What he noticed most, however, was a sign stating the modern town of Isthmia was 2 kilometers ahead. If the Oregon didn't get into position soon, he was going to be in trouble. The Jeep's gas gauge was staying above empty on the sheer force of his will. He heard his name in his earbud and had to adjust the volume on his radio. Juan here.
Chairman, it's Gomez. Linda and the others are safely aboard. I've got you on the drone, and Eric's making his calculations now, but you might want to slow down a touch.
You do see that other Jeep behind me, right?
I do, the chopper pilot drawled. But if we don't get this just right, you're going to end up like a fly on the wrong side of a swatter, if you know what I mean. The simile was more than apt. Thanks for the mental picture.
The road started to descend down to the coast. In order to save fuel, Juan mashed the clutch and let momentum and gravity take over for a few seconds. He drove with one eye on the side mirror, and a few seconds after spotting the responsivist's headlights, he eased off the clutch to let the engine engage again. The motor sputtered. It caught instantly, but gave another weak cough. Cabrillo used an old stock car driver's trick, weaving the Jeep to slosh the gasoline in the tank. It seemed to work because the engine purred.
Juan, Eric's finished with his number crunching, Adams said.
You're 870 meters from the bridge, meaning you're too close. You need to slow down to 50 miles an hour if we're to make this happen. The pursuing jeep was 80 yards back and closing. The road was too straight for Juan to do much maneuvering, and when he tried to swerve again so they would waste a shot, the motor wheezed. He cursed. I'm coming in hot. Tell Eric to goose the old girl and meet me. He entered the town of Ismia, a typical Greek seaside village. He could smell the sea and the iodine taint of drying fishing nets. The buildings were mostly whitewashed with the ubiquitous red-tiled roofs. Satellite dishes grew from many of them like high-tech mushrooms. The main drag opened on a small village square, and Cabrillo could see the stanchions that raised and lowered the narrow bridge to cross the canal beyond.
Okay, Chairman.
This time it was Eric in the earbud. You need to slow down now. Exactly 52 kilometers per hour or you're going to hit us.
You're sure?
It's simple vectors. High school physics, Eric replied as if he'd been insulted. Trust me. The crack of a rifle sounded behind Cabrillo. He had no idea where the bullet went, but had no choice but to ignore it and comply with Eric's directions. As he slowed, the AK-47 chattered on automatic. He could hear the bullets striking the jeep. One passed over his shoulder close enough to ruffle the cloth of his uniform shirt. The bridge was 50 yards away, and the responsivists maybe 50 yards behind him. Traveling at the required speed took every ounce of self-control Cabrillo possessed. The primitive part of his brain was screaming for him to floor it, to get out of there as fast as he could. Appearing like a colossus, the bow of the Oregon suddenly emerged from behind a four-story building that was blocking Juan's view of the canal. She never looked so beautiful. And suddenly, she was rearing up, her plates scraping against the bridge, as she had done when she'd first entered the canal. She rose higher and higher, climbing up the bridge as if she were cutting an ice pack. With a shearing clang, the mechanical systems that operated the bridge gave out under her titanic weight, and the ship crashed back into the canal with barely a check in her speed. Juan kept driving at her, seemingly bent on crashing into her armored flank. The men chasing him must have thought he was bent on suicide. 15 yards to go, and panic began to hit him. They'd timed it wrong. He was going to slam into the ship as she glided out of the canal. He could feel it. More gunfire erupted from behind him. It was answered by someone firing from the Oregon's railing. He saw the muzzle flash against the darkened hull. Seconds now. Speed, vectors, timing. He'd gambled and lost and was about to crank the wheel over when he spotted the yawning opening of the boat garage bathed in red battle lights. The Oregon was ballasted perfectly to the bottom lip of the ramp they used to launch Zodiacs, and their assault boat was just slightly lower than the roadway. Keeping it at exactly 52 kilometers per hour, he hit the end of the road, jumping the one-foot gap separating the damaged bridge from the Oregon and landing inside his ship. He hit the brakes and caromed into reinforced netting set up to stop boats during high-speed maneuvers. The jeep's airbag deployed, further cushioning Juan from the brutal deceleration. From outside, he heard the squeal of brakes. Tires dug in hard, but not hard enough. Spinning sideways, the pursuing jeep slammed into the hull with a dull ring and teetered against the plates as the ship passed by. Metal tore against metal as the Oregon ground the jeep against the side of the canal, flattening the vehicle and its occupants until Eric Stone gave a little lateral thrust and the jeep fell into the water. Max materialized at Cabrillo's side and helped him dig out from under the deflated airbag. Plan C, huh?
It worked, didn't it?
They exited the boat garage, Juan moving a little stiffly.
How's Kyle?
He's sedated down in medical with Hux.
We'll get him straightened out.
I know. Max stopped and looked into Juan's eyes. Thank you.
No thanks necessary.
They started walking toward the infirmary. If Plan C was this nuts, you've got to tell me about Plan D.
Oh, sure.
Juan grinned. Only problem with that one was we couldn't find enough Spartans to recreate the Battle of Thermopylae.